Okay, some reflections on the Dhamma. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato samma sambuddhassa. Buddhang saranang gacchami, dhammang saranang gacchami, sanghang saranang gacchami. Dutiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami, dutiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami, dutiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. Tatiyampi buddhang saranang gacchami, tatiyampi dhammang saranang gacchami, tatiyampi sanghang saranang gacchami. So nice to see everybody here today. Tuesday, the 18th. So had an interesting encounter just now, right before the meditation class. Went out to stretch my legs a bit, and then saw this raccoon. You know, so I was telling some people before I came, and. And I actually have this kind of a fear of raccoons, you know. When I lived in near Ottawa, and they had a lot of raccoons there, and they used to live in this area between these two barns, and in the wintertime they'd live there, and then they would just live there, and they'd kind of poo in this area between the two barns, and it would fall onto these garden tools, you know. And I was the junior monk, so in the spring I had to clean it, you know, or like that. And I remember one time I was down in Pickering visiting, and my friend had raccoons in his kind of boat, and he needed somebody to clean up the mess they left over the winter. And they couldn't find any regular maid or cleaning service who would do it. Apparently too dangerous. So finally they had to use the same people who clean up crime scenes to come and clean raccoon poo from his boat, you know. And so I was like, why is this? You know, it's kind of, you know, what do you need crime scene people to do this for? And so when I got back to the monastery, I looked it up, and it turns out raccoons have this kind of roundworm in their stomach. And in raccoons, this roundworm stays in their stomach and doesn't go anywhere. It just stays there. But in all the other species that come into, most of the other species that it comes into contact with, the worms migrate through that species' body into their brain, and they eat their brain, killing them. And so, you know, this, and then the raccoons go and scavenge the corpse of whatever it is that died, and then they get reinfected. So it's beneficial to these roundworms. And so I was like, why didn't anybody ever, you know, how come I didn't learn about this in school? This is like something from Star Trek. Like, I, you know, never heard about this kind of thing. So when I saw this raccoon, now whenever I see raccoons, I keep like a safe, you know, distance from raccoons. I kind of have this kind of raccoon perception. And so I was out there doing this kind of walking, or just walking around to stretch my legs, and this raccoon starts, you know, coming up, and usually they're like afraid of people, and they, if they see a person, they run away. But this one kept walking towards me, and I was like, what's happening, you know? And then it was like 15 feet away, and it was like 10 feet away, and I was like, oh my God, there's a raccoon. It's coming. It's 10 feet away, you know? So I ran, you know, kind of, you know, ran around the building, and the raccoon kind of looked confused and came around the other side, and then our friends here came, and some monks were outside, and it came up to them and started chasing them. And so apparently what's been happening is the raccoons and other animals get leftovers out the back there, and so they become kind of friendly towards people. And one of the monks kind of is taken to feeding them, you know? And apparently it even sits on his shoulder, so I'm gonna have to tell him about, you know, the real... Be careful of raccoons and wash your clothes. But these are kind of interesting things, you know, maybe about perception, right? Because I saw this raccoon and I thought, why is this raccoon coming? This thing might have rabies, you know, I better run. I'd actually heard this story, you know, not to tell too many raccoon stories, fill up the whole half hour with raccoon stories, but I'd heard this other story about a fellow who was on a walk with his wife, and he saw this kind of raccoon in the distance going like this, just kind of nodding. And then, you know, so, well, this is a kind of strange thing for a raccoon to be doing. And then the raccoon saw him. And when it saw him and his wife, it turned towards him and started kind of running after them. And so he started running. And the raccoon started running. But the raccoons, I mean, they're actually, you know, they can be reasonably fast. You know, I mean, humans, you might be able to outrun them if you're in good shape. They're not super fast. But this raccoon eventually caught up to him and started to try to attack him. And so he had to get I think he eventually made it to his car with his wife, and he had to get a tire iron, and it wouldn't stop until he killed it with this tire iron. So he had to kill it. And so this raccoon actually, you know, again, not to make anybody scared, but, you know, this raccoon had rabies, you know. And so apparently when they get this, they just, you know, want to attack, like, whatever's closest. And then after that, that fellow, you know, you have like 24 or 48 hours to get a shot. Otherwise, you're in big trouble. So my perception seeing this raccoon is kind of, uh-oh, from Perth Monastery, you know. This raccoon, this story about this guy who got attacked by a raccoon. And why is this raccoon 10 feet away from me? And the raccoon's perception is, this guy has some food, you know, kind of sees me and starts thinking that I have food that I can give him, you know. And so there's these two kind of completely different perceptions. And of course, you know, we have a perception. We have to kind of make our best judgment, you know, on the basis of that perception, you know. So in my case, you know, it might have been embarrassing if people saw me kind of running from a raccoon. What's this monk? You know, he's so scared. He's running. In Thailand, the monks like face down tigers. You know, there's like all these stories of monks going into the wilderness and there's a tiger there and it like growls and they just keep meditating, you know. But you know, here there's a raccoon and I'm like hightailing it out of there. It's like, it's kind of not even taking the chance. Never mind. Keep meditating. I was clear around the building, you know. You know, so there's this kind of danger. Somebody sees me, you know, might get a little bit embarrassed, but, you know, have to make these kind of decisions based on the perceptions I have, right? And this raccoon, he sees me, he thinks, oh, this other monk's really friendly, you know, he's giving me food, but actually I'm relatively unfriendly towards raccoons. I'm not, I'm not like a raccoon-friendly monk. Actually, I... It was after these raccoons got into the shed, I had to trap them. So so we got this huge trap, and I would bait the trap. And there was one mother, and she would have new kids every year. And I really wanted to catch this mother raccoon. These were live traps. They weren't, you know, obviously it weren't harming the raccoon. But kept trapping them. And I remember this mother was so huge. When it went into the cage, it was able to like break out of the cage, you know. And so I was kind of like getting like a Captain Ahab, you know, in Moby Dick, where he's just totally obsessed with catching this whale, and I was like obsessed with catching this raccoon. So eventually we caught it and released it. So, you know, this raccoon sees me. It's like, oh, there's a, you know, friendly monk wearing a robe, and they give me food. But I'm sitting there thinking, you know, I would trap you and relocate you, you know, so you don't cause me any problems, you know. And of course, this kind of thing, kind of funny, you know, raccoon and, you know, a monk. And, you know, of course, no harm, no foul, you know, no problem. Raccoon will eat another day, and I live to tell the tale to everybody here today. But this is the interesting thing about the way that our mind works. We have a kind of past association with something, you know? Kind of in the past, this is what this, you know, thing did to me, or this is what this person did to me, or this is what this tone of voice did to me. And then whenever we hear this kind of past association, past thing that we used to see, past tone of voice, it triggers these kind of memories. It kind of triggers these perceptions. And we tend to react in the way that we've been habituated to, in the way that we've learned to react. So remember hearing these kind of stories about people who'd been in Vietnam, you know, and they would hear like a car, you know, the old cars. I don't think the new cars do this, but back in the days, the cars would sometimes, their mufflers, I don't know how they work, they would go like boom, like kind of, you know, they kind of backfire and they have this loud sound, you know, when they're starting. And when these people heard that, they kind of like hit the ground or like pull the people who were around with them to the ground, because this this previous association from the war, from hearing kind of grenades and bullets, was so strong. You know? And of course, there's a survival mechanism in this. You know, we have to have past associations with things. We can't, in each new situation, find out totally what this raccoon is like. You know, every time I meet a new raccoon, I don't know what's up with this raccoon. You know, the research that I've done, it makes sense. You know. And yet, in this situation, it was completely inaccurate. Right? This raccoon did not have rabies, you know. This raccoon's perception of me wasn't, I mean, it's fine, the raccoon wants to live there. I didn't have any food, you know, but we both reacted in the ways that we're used to, according to the perceptions that we've built up. You know? And so the interesting thing about these perceptions is that a lot of the time, they're not conscious, kind of, which makes them even more powerful, you know. They were something that kind of happened to us, good or bad, in our past, and just built up. We learned to react in a particular way. And whenever that kind of thing comes up, whenever that kind of trigger comes up, we go with it. You know? And this kind of thing is one of the things the Buddha calls kind of dependent co-arising. You know, we have a kind of craving. You know, we want something to be a certain way. We have clinging. We cling to it becoming that. We cling to it being that way. Then we have becoming. We become a person who's like that, born into a world of experience like that. And this is the way these kind of habit patterns get built up. Now, when these habit patterns get built up in this way, when they become something that seems to be consistent, you know, something that seems to be happening all the time, this is what we tend to take as ourself. It's what we tend to take as our personality, you know. So I know these days, some jobs, even before we have, or before you go in for an interview, or when you go in for your interview, they make you take this kind of personality test, kind of Myers-Briggs personality test. You got your kind of aggressive types, you got your kind of passive types, you got your kind of mixed between types, you got all these different types of peoples, and these are their kind of personalities. These are the way they are. Yeah? And the interesting thing is that when people come to meditation, what tends to happen is that these kind of tests, their categories that they used to get boxed into, get kind of fuzzy. They get harder to box into a particular category. And actually, my suspicion is that if people went to different cultures around the world, some of those boxes might not fit, you know, in the same way they do in the cultures where these tests were invented, you know. So this is the interesting thing. We have these aspects of our mind, these kind of constant perceptions that we have, you know, that we can take to be ourself, you know. This is who I am, you know. I'm a person who's shy. I'm a person who's angry. I'm a person who's competent. I'm a person who's incompetent. You know, I'm a person who acts this way when this happens, who doesn't when that happens, you know. And this is who we are, you know. Now, the thing about this kind of perception that we have, this is who we are, is that this kind of perception is that something that's often built up unconsciously through causes and effects, but it gives us a kind of feeling of a place of safety. You know? If this is who I am, if this is my kind of essence, you know, then this is something that doesn't change. This is something that I can carry with me wherever I go. You know, this is something that will be safe. Yeah. So I remember I had a friend back in university days, and he went on a kind of an exchange to South America. And when he came back, he was like, you know, exchange is really great, you know. You know, you learn a lot of things, and he had a lot of great stories. And he said, one of the things you can take away is that no matter where you go, you still got that essence, you know, that who you are, right? But the interesting thing is that in Buddhism, the Buddha flips it around. So in Buddhism, there's this concept of anatta, which is not self. So in other words, however we think we're defining ourself, it's always changing. This kind of thing that we think is ourselves, these emotions, these thoughts, this body, these habits, all these things were built up from stimuli, from cause and effect, and they have a momentum. And some of them can seem pretty solid, but they're all subject to change. If we stop putting that stimulus into place, then our perceptions change, our reactions change, our personality changes, and then where's ourself? So for example, if instead of me having to clean these raccoon tools all the time, I started feeding raccoons like Bunte, and I had a raccoon pet who'd been declawed and taken to the vet, so there was no possibility of it having worms, then I had this raccoon and I lived with it for like 10 years, feeding it and playing with it, and it was always cuddling me. Then probably after doing that for 10 years, my perception of raccoons would change. Become like a raccoon person. In other words, this kind of habit would change. You know? And this is actually one of the things, one of the areas where often a lot of suffering can arise. You know? Because in defining ourselves as a particular personality, there's one teacher who says it really well. He says, when we define ourselves, we actually limit ourselves. You know? When we have a set of perceptions, this is who I am, this is the way that I'm going to react, this is what I can do, this is what I can't do, we limit ourselves to changing outside of those boundaries. You know? So this is one of the things. If we have this perception, you know, I'm a person who's like this, then when the conditions change, when they start to undercut this perception of who we are, we suffer big from that sometimes. You know? So I was actually talking, you know, with a friend, you know, a while back, and we both used to like to run when we were young, kind of young guys used to run track and do all this kind of things, and we used to kind of compete against each other running track, you know. And you know, over time, of course, you know, you're not that young anymore, you know. And so, if I have this kind of perception, I'm a person who can kind of run track. You know, I'm really good at this. Then as that ability starts to change to run around the track, you know, as the perception of yourself starts to change, it's like, what happened, you know? Maybe that wasn't really who I was at all. Maybe the thing that I'm seeing now is my true essence. And so instead of being like a safe place, this idea of a true essence becomes something scary, you know? Oh, I was a person who previously could communicate really well with people. People used to really like me. And then all of a sudden, in 5 or 10 or 12 communications with people, people seem to be getting angry. You know, when you're talking to them, it's like, what happened? What happened to my essence? Maybe that person who could really communicate, that wasn't the real me. Maybe what I'm seeing right now, this person who's, you know, being fumbly with their words, who doesn't seem to be getting the message across, maybe that's my real essence. And the other thing was just passing through, you know? So the liberating aspect of taking on this kind of teaching of not self, taking on this teaching that these kind of perceptions, these kind of habits, all these different things aren't who we are, is that we remove the limitations that we had previously. If we have this perception of not self, then a person who's really shy can become a person who's not shy. You know? A person who's too domineering can become a person who's very gentle. You know, a person who has these kind of cravings for ice cream, it's not possible to... I knew a guy who used to eat a liter of ice cream like every week. He couldn't stop. But if we're a person who's eaten that liter of ice cream, the perception of not self is that this is something that we can change. It's not our true essence. So when we have this kind of perception of not self, we keep applying that. Whenever something comes up, this is something we have firmly in our mind, then the question stops becoming like, what is my true essence, you know? Like, what is it that I can truly hang on to? What's the real me? Who's my true self? The question flips and becomes, what's skillful or unskillful to cultivate? in this situation? You know, what's skillful or unskillful to cultivate as a way to move forward? You know? So in other words, instead of having an essence as a thing that we're grabbing onto for safety, we have the Dhamma as a thing we're grabbing onto for safety. We have this attempt to build and grow in wholesome qualities as a thing that we're grabbing onto for safety. And this is a liberating thing, because regardless of whether or not we lose or gain these various external things, we always have the capacity to train our minds. We always have the capacity in any situation to try to bring our minds to wholesome mental objects. So there's this very kind of famous sutta in the canon called the Anuruddha Sutta. And it's with this monk who's living alone in the forest, and he lives wearing kind of a cast-off rags for his robe. So the rags in those days weren't like the rags in these days. They were like rags. Like if it was in a rag heap, it was done probably. You know, it probably wasn't like the nice rags you get here today. They're like totally fine. And he used to eat alms food. He would only eat the food that got put into his bowl. So whatever food came in from the poor rich houses, he would eat that. And his dwelling place was underneath the root of a tree. So that's where he lived instead of having a house. And the Buddha appeared to him and he said to him, he was thinking these kind of what they call the eight thoughts of a great man, which I won't go into. But the Buddha appeared to him and he said, "Very good, good that you think these eight thoughts of a great man. And when you think these eight thoughts of a great man, you learn to concentrate your mind, you learn to focus on the, you learn to cultivate the jhanas, then this meal of alms food to you will seem like a big kind of like householder's banquet with various types of sauces and curries put in it, And he says, when you learn to cultivate these eight thoughts of a great man and have the four jhanas, then this kind of robe of cast-off rags will seem to you just like a householder's kind of closet full of beautiful clothes, And I can't remember, I think this one's in there too, but when you learn to cultivate these four jhanas and you're dwelling at the root of a tree, I think he says this too, we'll learn to see it as kind of like a householder's kind of like palace, In other words, the happiness that we get in a given situation comes from our minds. And when we learn to bring our minds to this kind of training, to training in wholesome qualities, we learn to develop this kind of joy that can come kind of welling up from within us, And this isn't a joy that's dependent on the consumption of external sensual pleasures. It isn't a joy that's dependent on having this idea, this is my true self, this is who I am. It's a kind of joy that comes from training the mind in a proper way, from learning to develop a skill in the mind. And when a person has this skill, they have this kind of joy. And they're kind of, wherever they're dwelling is a nice dwelling. Wherever they're walking, it's nice to walk. Wherever they're sitting, it's nice to sit. Extent when people have this kind of joy and they lose it, they kind of pine to get it back, But these are some of the benefits of bringing our mind constantly back to training, constantly back to developing in wholesome qualities, never quitting in this, trying to get better at this, These are some of the benefits of cultivating this perception of not self, This is not who I am. Instead of this is who I am, this is not who I am. This kind of angry person is not who I am. This shy person is not who I am. This kind of person who can do this or can't do that is not who I am. It's all subject to change. We cultivate this perception in this way, and the question becomes, what should I do right now to make myself more skillful? How can I train my mind in this situation? And so this is a liberating thing, because rather than just having this fixed perception, this is how it's going to be, this is who I am, we instead break those boundaries. We no longer have those barriers. This is how it's going to be, this is who I am. Instead, we have the perception, what is it that I should train myself to become? What's the most skillful type of becoming to take on? And when we learn to do this, we learn to become constant at this, we learn to become skilled at this. Wherever we're dwelling is a nice place to dwell. Wherever we're sitting is a nice place to dwell. Wherever we're lying down is a nice place to dwell. We do these things at ease. We do these things with a sense of peace and happiness. And this is something that we have to experience for ourselves. But it's one of the benefits that can come, even beyond the benefit of not being afraid of raccoons. you know, beyond the benefit of, you know, whatever, not getting into awkward social situations, having this kind of peace of mind that can grow is something that's great about the Buddhist teachings and something we can get through cultivating this perception of not self and practicing meditation. Okay, so I think I'll leave that for your reflection.